Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, October 5th, 2015. Well, the secrecy will finally be lifted because President Obama's corporate legacy is being advanced, he thinks, by the deal that has been finalized called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a bad trade deal. And for starters, it has been negotiated in secret. Even members of Congress who have wanted to look at the draft of this agreement have had to go to a secret room without staff members where they couldn't take notes and review the, I think it's 28 or 30 chapters in this deal. And those who have seen it, who aren't allowed to tell us what they see, have at least passed along, and of course there have been some leaks to enhance this, grave concerns that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is only narrowly about trade and the relaxation of trade barriers. And the real target here is Japan, which has restricted American imports, including automobiles, for years. And from what we know about the draft, Japan gets as long as 20 years to reduce its barriers to imports of American cars and other products. But the impact on the United States will come far sooner. Now, of course, I'm guessing about a lot of this because we haven't seen what is in the deal. It's an 11-nation partnership, and it's designed to try to put a package together that favors the U.S. and its trading partners over China and its trading partners in Asia and elsewhere. And so we will have to wait in about 30 days, based on the fast-track legislation. The president will have to release the full draft to the public and to all members of the House and Senate. Each House only gets one up or down vote. No amendments are permitted. And so this is a take-it-or-leave-it package. I'm a little surprised to hear Ford Motor Company, which is a transnational automaker, jump in and say that it is opposed to the deal. Quote, to ensure the future competitiveness of American manufacturing, we recommend Congress not approve TPP in its current form. So it's 30 chapters that'll be released in about a month. We already know that labor unions, environmentalists, and liberal activists, professional leftists like me, are arguing that the agreement favors big business over workers and environmental protection. Donald Trump is on our side this time. He's called the Pacific Trade Accord a bad deal. Of course, he says he could make a better deal because he's so smart and so rich. And Bernie Sanders, to his credit, has long been opposed to it. Hillary Clinton, I don't think, has taken a firm position. She's been kind of bobbing and weaving. She supported it as Secretary of State and is hinting now that her support will not be forthcoming. And just a quick comment. I don't know if you saw Mrs. Clinton on Saturday Night Live, but as a critic of hers, I give her a lot of credit. Instead of coming on and playing herself, she sat across a bar, played the role of a bartender, serving up drinks to candidate Hillary Clinton, played by an actress. And it was really pretty well done. Now, they didn't touch the email scandal or Benghazi, so it's clear that Saturday Night Live played ball with the Clinton campaign. But she did admit that she was late to the game in supporting gay marriage, and she's promised to fix that. And she also blurted out that it took her a long time to decide about the Keystone XL pipeline. So it was a funny bit, and I give Hillary Clinton credit for coming across as human, as self-critical, having a bit of humility, and those are all things that I've never said about her before. Back to the TPP, Sandra Levin, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, a Democrat from Michigan, was the only member of Congress who went to Atlanta to monitor the final talks, which bogged down over the weekend over pharmaceutical and dairy product issues. And Levin, objects to the language addressing Japan's devaluation of its currency, which is in a side letter, not in the main agreement. And he says it will be hard to enforce any currency manipulation by Japan over the course of this agreement. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because there is a very strong opposition to it. And the president got his fast-track legislation passed, not with Democratic votes, but with Republicans. And given the climate over immigration, Planned Parenthood, all of the games that the Republicans play, will they, you know, support this deal and hold their noses that they're helping Obama cement his pro-corporate legacy? Or will they revert to previous form and oppose it because he's for it? It's a real conflict for corporate Democrats and Republicans, and it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out. At this point, I have to favor the president's prospects for passage of the deal intact. Because bottom line is, Congress is fed and nurtured by corporate cash. And that is not lost on them. Here's another example. In Washington right now, this has been off the radar, but the multinational oil companies are pushing hard to lift the 40-year ban on export of American crude oil. They're playing the jobs card. I think they're arguing that fracking and the development of the tar sands extraction are at risk because the price of oil has dropped so precipitously. It's been below $50 a barrel for some time now. And so the oil barons are sloshing money around Washington, at least $70 million this year in lobbying funds. They've financed organizations whose scholars have generated reports praising the proposal. We call that academic propaganda. It has placed op-eds in Capitol Hill newspapers, paid for TV spots in key markets. And the industry has named a dozen Democratic House members they're trying to pressure, again, to lift the ban on exports of crude oil produced in the United States. And this, of course, is such a contradiction of the issues of climate change and the real urgency that we face. Instead of addressing climate change, the American Congress will likely vote to prop up the American-based multinational oil companies that have no allegiance to the United States whatsoever. Now to the conflict in Syria, where Russian warplanes continue to fly sorties and, in fact, have attacked Islamic State positions. In fact, they appear to have attacked some Islamic State positions that the U.S. could have attacked before, but, oh, for whatever reasons, has not. But this is producing some fallout because Turkey has filed some deep objections at NATO and elsewhere, after a Russian warplane reportedly violated Turkish airspace near the border with Syria. Now, part of this story, this is from Al Jazeera, says that in response, Turkey scrambled two F-16 jets. But in another part of the story, they say that the Russian fighter exited Turkish airspace into Syria after it was intercepted by two F-16s from Turkish Air Force, which were conducting patrols in the region. Well, Turkey doesn't quite have a straight story there, but Russia has now apparently acknowledged that it was a mistake and that that won't happen again. And I want to stress that this next item has not been reported in any of the corporate media outlets that I survey every day. This is coming from multiple reports on the web, and the one that I grabbed here is from a website, Strategica 51, and I can't vouch for them, all right? It was republished by the truthseeker.co.uk, and it reads thusly, six Russian fighter jets intercepted four Israeli McDonnell Douglas F-15 fighter bombers attempting to infiltrate the Syrian coast. The Israeli warplanes have been flying over Syrian airspace for months, and in particular, the coast of Latakia, which is now the bridgehead of Russian forces and the important airbase that they have developed in Syria. Now, according to this account, and again, I cannot vouch for it entirely, They say the practice has been for Israeli jets to follow a complex flight pattern and approach Latakia from the sea. On the night of, and here this report says, both 1 October and October 02. it's a little bit flaky here. Six Su-30 Russian fighters took off from a Syrian base in the direction of Cyprus before changing course and intercepting the four Israeli F-15 fighters off the coast of Syria. So this illustrates, both on the Turkish side and the Israeli side, that the entry of Russia into this hot war in Syria is really high risk for all parties involved in this. And again, I forgive me my language, but the best way to describe this is a clusterfuck. And on top of that, 1 week ago today, we were told that one of the outcomes of the one-on-one meeting between Putin and Obama at the United Nations was a pledge from Putin that no Russian ground troops would be sent to Syria. Well, maybe he had his fingers crossed. Or maybe what he said was a carefully crafted statement that allowed a loophole for what I'm reporting now. Russia has signaled that it is strongly hinting that its volunteer ground forces would soon be fighting there. These are the volunteers that Russia has said were fighting in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. Are they the exact same individuals? I don't know. In fact, there's a lot I don't know about this. Let me just be candid. But if Russia puts volunteer fighters on the ground, and just today, Iran has announced that it's sending up to 600 ground fighters to support the Assad government, well, it will really change the nature of this war. Now, here is a stunning statement published in the New York Times. I'm going to read it verbatim. Russia's intervention already appears to have subverted diplomatic efforts to halt the war led by a special United Nations envoy, Staffan de Mistura. 41 rebel factions who oppose Mr. Assad said in a statement on Monday that Russia's, quote, brutal occupation has cut the road to any political solution. Now, last week, with some surprise, I shared with you the names of rebel groups in Syria that I had never heard of. And let me say that while I'm not steeped in this, I'm not an academic, I pay close attention to what's going on in Syria. And I'd never heard of these groups that were named. I can't even, you know, roll them off my tongue or the top of my bald head for you right now. But 41 rebel factions? 41? I mean, this is incredible. And when you talk about rebel factions, these are not the Kiwanis Club of Damascus, the Rotary of Homs, the Odd Fellows of Aleppo. These are groups that are supported by outsiders. Some of them are being supported by your tax dollars and mine, some from Saudi Arabia, some from the Emirates, and who knows where else. But 41 groups on the ground, and they've all signed a letter rejecting peace talks? Well, this is going to be a long one. And so these volunteers that Russia is committing, are they in fact contractors or mercenaries? That's how we would do it. Do they get a bonus when they return? Do their families get a payment if they get killed? I don't know. But what really is interesting to me is to hear the Obama administration officials pound their chests and declare how wrong Russia is to enter the fray in Syria. Here's Ashton Carter, the defense secretary. Their approach, which is to support Assad rather than a political transition, while meanwhile fighting opponents of Assad, is doomed to fail. Ashton Carter said that at a news conference in Madrid today. He said the U.S. and its allies want to fight the Islamic State and work toward a political transition in which Assad would leave office. Russia seems to believe you can have one without the other. Now, I mean, it's the U.S. policy that is incoherent. It's the idea that using surrogates and air support, that we can defeat both the Islamic State and the brutal military of a dictator named Assad. It's pure fantasy and sheer folly. And for us to lecture the Russians, Obama used the phrase quagmire at his press conference late on Friday. An attempt by Russia and Iran to prop up Assad and try to pacify the population is just going to get them stuck in a quagmire, and it won't work. And they will be there for a while if they don't take a different course. Well, Mr. Obama, you just described the American position. We've gotten ourselves into a quagmire, and it's not working, and it won't work, and we're going to be there for a while. And so to hear him excoriate Russia and Putin in particular. Here's another quote. The problem here is Assad and the brutality he's inflicted on the Syrian people. Obama said, while the U.S. will work with all parties to broker a transition, we are not going to cooperate with a Russian campaign to simply try to destroy anybody who is disgusted and fed up with Mr. Assad's behavior. Now, these 41 groups are not disgusted and fed up. They're opportunists who see a way of taking down this government. And it has been a priority of the U.S., of Israel, of many of the PNAC neocons for a long time to take down Assad. And so to act like we're the good guys and that the Russians are the bad guys entering this picture, it's really just insulting to our intelligence. And so the carnage will continue. The New York Times spilled about 2,000 words with a lead story on, not a lead story, but a front page story on the Sunday paper. And it's kind of written by Captain Obvious here. U.S. financing fails to sustain forces in Iraq, Syria, or Afghanistan. That's right. The claims of the billions of dollars that we've spent sharing our brilliance in military affairs with these nations is all a total failure. It's a waste of our money. And that's playing out in Afghanistan right now, where we struck a hospital in Kunduz run by Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontier, and killed 22 people. And the shifting response, the shifting narratives offered by the U.S. government have landed on this one as General John Campbell, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, held a news conference at the Pentagon, changing the story. And the story was that we had to hit the hospital because there were Taliban fighters nearby. But Doctors Without Borders flatly says there was no fighting around the hospital. The building was hit over and over by airstrikes on a Saturday morning, even though the group had sent the American military the precise coordinates of its hospital so it could be avoided. And this attack was conducted using a C-130. That's a huge cargo plane that flies at very slow speeds, and it's not really the right the right plane to use. I guess we're down to the remnants in Afghanistan. But now General Campbell says that American special forces were with the Afghan forces, and the Afghans asked for air support from a special forces team, and they called it in. Now, the special forces team is just training and advising the Afghan troops. Wink, wink, nod, nod. So Doctors Without Borders is not taking it. They say the description of the attack keeps changing from collateral damage to a tragic accident to now attempting to pass responsibility to the Afghan government. The reality is the U.S. dropped these bombs. The U.S. hit a huge hospital full of wounded patients and staff. The U.S. military remains responsible for the targets it hits, even though it's part of a coalition. There can be no justification for this horrible attack. Well said. General Campbell is in Washington to testify to Congress on the dramatic great progress we're making in Afghanistan. also confirmed that it was an AC-130 gunship used to conduct the strike, a slow-moving cargo plane equipped with large-caliber guns and a howitzer. It's really shocking what we have descended to. Meanwhile, concerns are growing that we may be on the verge of a third intifada, a Palestinian uprising. And depending on who you talk to, the Israelis say the Palestinians started and vice versa. But Israeli authorities have banned non-resident Palestinians from the old city of Jerusalem. Tensions are simmering in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Two Israeli victims of a stabbing attack were laid to rest, and Palestinians in the hundreds clashed with police and soldiers. Now, I don't condone the violence on either side, and innocent people are being attacked. We reported on Friday about the settler couple, the Israelis, who were shot and killed by presumably a Palestinian who the Israelis say they have now detained. Now, we also have the case of teenagers, Palestinian teenagers, who were shot and killed in two incidents over the weekend. And clashes have erupted between Palestinian youth and Israeli security forces across the West Bank. More than 100 Palestinians wounded after a violent stretch in Jerusalem that included a pair of stabbings that I just mentioned. Confrontations broke out in several Palestinian refugee camps at two Israeli security checkpoints in the Issa-Wiwa neighborhood, the home of a Palestinian man who was shot to death by police after he stabbed a 15-year-old Israeli on Sunday. And from here, it's very hard to understand or to determine who's telling the truth and who may be spinning. Every day, I like to pause and mention the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Don Cisney is a monthly subscriber who does double of what he needs to do. Thank you, Don. Ted Kelly is a longtime supporter. Alexandra Marin just renewed her annual subscription. And Andy Krieger's been supporting me for many years now. I want to thank those individuals and ask you to join them. We had a couple of new signups over the weekend. I appreciate that. And it's your turn to come to peterbcollins.com, our newly revised website. And by the way, I've got a bill to pay to the webmaster this week, so I'd appreciate it if you can help me with this transition, because we upgraded the website to be more friendly to your mobile phone and your tablets. We've got the new iPhone, iPad app that's available at the Apple App Store. And, of course, we continue to feed our daily podcasts to Stitcher, to TuneIn, to iTunes, and many other places where people access our podcasts. But I couldn't do it without your support, and I'm asking you for extra help right now because I do have some additional expenses that I need to cover. So come on over and click on the menu button on the upper right corner of the homepage. And underneath that, on the pull down, become a subscriber is your next click. And there you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere in the entire world earn a gift from me. It's the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest book called Empire of Chaos. Well, I've grown kind of tired of what I call the tut-tut-tutting about the brief encounter that Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis, who refuses to issue same-sex marriage licenses, had in Washington when Pope Francis was there. As I've said, Pope Francis meets with a lot of different people. The Vatican has gone out of its way to de-emphasize this meeting, saying she was just one of many people that he saw and had a picture taken with. And frankly, I would, you know, I'm not at all surprised that the Pope would meet with supporters of, or I'm sorry, with opponents of same-sex marriage who happen to be Catholics or Christians, and that he would think that it's courageous for someone to refuse to issue licenses of something that he considers to be immoral. And so I think there's been a lot of projection, and I guess it comes from Catholic and Christian gay groups in the United States who think they can shame the Pope over his meeting with Kim Davis. And I just think it's misplaced, and as I said last week, on the narrow question of her religious freedom, I support her conscientious objection here. She doesn't have to issue same-sex marriage licenses. She has to quit her job. She can't have it both ways. She can't refuse to issue the licenses and continue to be county clerk and pretend to uphold the law. But she has the right to leave that job in protest. And the Vatican has revealed the true colors of the Pope and the Catholic Church today. Because this is written not that the Pope personally did it, but the Vatican as an entity dismissed a Polish priest from his job in the Vatican after he came out as gay, called for changes in Roman Catholic teachings, and introduced his partner. His name is Krzysztof Karamsa, and he worked at the enforcement arm of the church, which is called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So it's very interesting that he's right there, essentially, in the Inquisition office at the Vatican. And he had the courage to come out and take his stand. He is a conscientious objector in the same way that Kim Davis is. And the Vatican had no problem firing him. So I think that these are somewhat equivalent. And I think they expose that despite the kinder, gentler Catholic that Pope Francis presents, he's still a hardliner on church orthodoxy, and it's not going to change anytime soon. Well, now we know why Jason Chaffetz was so aggressive in the hearing last week where he took on Cecile Richards of Planned Parenthood and lost. Because he formally announced yesterday that he is running for Speaker in the Republican-controlled House. And I think that was his audition last week, trying to pander to the far right in his party who squeezed out John Boehner and are looking for one of their own, or something close to it, as the next speaker. So in addition to Kevin McCarthy, the loose-lipped Bakersfield, California congressman, the third candidate is Dan Webster of Florida, who was the Speaker of the House in Florida, and he's promising that lawmakers will be able to offer amendments and use parliamentary tricks, which were blocked by John Boehner. I'm not sure that has much appeal in this divided caucus these days, but the vote will come later this week, and we'll see who surfaces as the winner and who gets voted off the island. I just want to touch briefly on the incidents of extreme weather that are plaguing the planet here in this October. The American cargo ship, the 800-foot El Faro, that disappeared last Thursday near the Bahamas, has sunk. There were 33 people in the crew, 28 Americans, 5 Polish citizens. Before it lost contact, the El Faro had sent out a distress signal reporting it had lost propulsion and was taking on water. But it was subjected to 140-mile-an-hour winds, seas of 50 feet, and zero visibility. Now, one of the lifeboats has been found and was described as heavily damaged. And questions are being raised about why the captain continued his journey into that storm. And likely, the speculation is that dead in the water with no functioning engines, the ship would have been blown sideways to the force of the storm and then struck broadside by waves and wind. And a big, long container ship like that would break up, oh, kind of like a balsa wood bathtub toy. Meanwhile, in Guatemala, at least 130 people have been killed in a mudslide near Guatemala City. In Asia, authorities in China and the Philippines say that a typhoon that tore through the northern Philippines before roaring ashore in southern China has killed somewhere between 9 and 15 people. I can't quite tell if it's the same typhoon or a separate one that hit Guangdong, that's southern China near Hong Kong, on Sunday, where at least 6 were killed and 168 wounded. And here in the United States, Columbia, South Carolina is the dateline for a story of massive flooding in South Carolina. And many people link this to Hurricane Joaquin, but were told no. This was part of an unusual weather combination involving a slow-crawling, low-pressure system that meteorologists called unusually deep for this time of year. And the flooding is expected to stay because it wasn't just blown in by a hurricane. Governor Nikki Haley says that we can't just move the water out. It may take weeks for drainage to occur. This is very interesting for its timing. As you know, the events at Umpqua College in Roseburg, Oregon, occurred last Thursday, October 1st, which left 9 students and the shooter dead. Well, the day before, 3 students at Somerville High School in Tuolumne, California, that's a rural area about 120 miles east and north of San Francisco, were outed by fellow students. And the sheriff now reports they had a highly detailed plan to shoot and kill fellow students and teachers. Now, there were 3 students identified at first, and a 4th was added to the conspirators after the sheriff's investigation. Apparently, the administration acted very quickly when they heard rumors from students. They pulled the 3 suspects out of class. They searched their lockers and established that there was no immediate threat. But the sheriff said their plot was pretty doggone close to fruition. So we don't know further details, but apparently they even knew the names of people they were planning to kill. And this is not a copycat crime, because this was busted up, as I say, the night before the rampage in Roseburg. And I am listening to what passes for this conversation about gun violence in this country following the Roseburg incident. So far, I'm sorry to say, I haven't heard anything new, and I haven't seen any of the chemistry or dynamics shift to the point where we can expect real action that might prevent this in the future. I'll keep looking, and when I see something worth talking about, I'll mention it here. Hey, thanks for listening to my ranting and raving and occasional foul language. Your comments are always welcome. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.